Jewish War, Book 1. The War of the Jews against the Romans was the greatest not only of the wars of our own time, but, one might almost say, of all the wars between cities or between nations that report has handed down to us. Yet it has not been written up as it deserves. Some who were not present at the events have gathered up random and inconsistent hearsay and written it up in the manner of sophists. Others who were present have falsified the facts, some out of flattery toward the Romans, some out of hatred for the Jews, so that their books contain now denunciation and now panegyric, but nowhere the precision of true history. I have therefore set myself, for the benefit of those who live under Roman rule, to render into Greek the account I had earlier composed in my native tongue and sent to the barbarians of the interior. I am Joseph, son of Matthias, a priest from Jerusalem, who fought against the Romans myself in the opening stages of the war and was present, of necessity, at everything that followed. For when this vast upheaval broke out, the internal affairs of the Romans were in sickness, and the revolutionary party among the Jews, seizing the troubled times, rose up flourishing in both manpower and money. So much so that, amid the excessive turmoil, some regions of the East were gripped by hope of gain and others by fear of loss. The Jews hoped that their kinsmen beyond the Euphrates would rise with them, while on the Roman side, the neighboring Gauls were restive, and the Celtic country would not stay quiet. Everything was full of disorder after Nero's death, and the moment tempted many to reach for the throne, while the armies, in hope of profit, longed for a change of masters. I thought it monstrous to let the truth wander astray amid events of such magnitude, to let the Parthians and Babylonians and the most distant Arabs, and our own kinsmen beyond the Euphrates, the Adiabenians, learn through my careful account exactly where the war began, through what sufferings it ran its course, and how it ended, while the Greeks and those Romans who took no part in the campaign remain ignorant of it, dependent on flattering or fictional accounts. And yet these writers have the nerve to entitle their works histories, works which, besides telling nothing sound, seem to me to miss their very purpose as well. For they wish to make the Romans appear great, yet they constantly disparage and belittle the Jews. I do not see, however, how conquerors of the weak can be thought great. These writers respect neither the length of the war, nor the numbers of the exhausted Roman army, nor the stature of the generals who labored so hard around Jerusalem, labor which, I think, they find humiliating to their reputation if the achievement is made to look small. I, for my part, have no intention of competing with those who exalt Rome by inflating the deeds of my own people. I will set out the actions of both sides with precision, but the reflections that arise from the events I reserve for my own feelings, allowing myself to grieve over the calamities of my country. That internal strife destroyed her, and that it was the tyrants of the Jews who drew down the unwilling hands of the Romans and the fire onto the temple, Caesar Titus himself, the very man who sacked the city, can testify. Throughout the whole war, he pitied the populace held under guard by the insurgents, and often deliberately postponed the city's capture, giving the siege more time so the guilty might yet repent. If anyone should charge me with slander for the things I say against the tyrants and their banditry, or for lamenting my country's misfortunes, let him excuse the feeling, even if it goes against the rule of history. For of all the cities under Roman rule, ours rose to the greatest prosperity and fell back again to the depths of disaster. Indeed, measured against the calamities of the Jews, I think all the misfortunes of every age since the beginning of the world are found wanting. And no foreigner was to blame for them, so that it was impossible to master one's grief. If some judge should prove harsher than pity allows, let him assign the events to history and the lamentations to the writer. And yet I might justly reproach the learned men of Greece, who, though events of such magnitude occurred in their own time, events that make the wars of old look small by comparison, sit in judgment on them, carping at those who strove to record them, though in eloquence they may surpass, in purpose they fall short. Instead, they write about the Assyrians and the Medes, as though the ancient historians had told those stories none too well. Yet they fall as far short of those old writers in power of composition as they do in seriousness of purpose. For the ancients each strove to write of their own times, precisely because presence at the events gave their account vividness, and lying in front of those who knew the truth would have been shameful. But to preserve past events for memory, and to hand down the record of one's own age to those who come after, is worthy of praise and gratitude. A man is not industrious merely for reworking someone else's arrangement and structure, but only if, while saying something new, he builds the very body of his history as his own. For my part, at very great expense and labor, I, a foreigner, dedicate to Greeks and Romans alike this record of great achievements. But among our own people, the mouth and tongue that gape wide open at once over profits and lawsuits are struck dumb the moment it comes to history, where one must speak the truth and gather the facts with much labor. They yield the field to the weaker sort, men who do not even know how to write of the deeds of their leaders. Let the truth of history, then, be honored among us, since it has been neglected among the Greeks. As for tracing the ancient history of the Jews, who they were, how they departed from Egypt, what country they wandered through and how much of it they later occupied, and how they migrated from it. I judged this untimely now, and in any case superfluous, since many Jews before me have set out the history of our ancestors with precision, and some Greeks too, translating those accounts into their own tongue, have not strayed far from the truth. I will begin my narrative where those writers and our own prophets left off. Of what follows, I will treat the war of my own time in greater detail and with as much thoroughness as I can manage, while the events before my own lifetime I will run through briefly. How Antiochus, called Epiphanes, took Jerusalem by force, held it for 3 years and 6 months, and was driven out of the country by the sons of Asamoneus. How their descendants, quarreling over the kingship, then drew the Romans and Pompey into their affairs. And how Herod, son of Antipater, brought in Sosius and put an end to their dynasty. How the people rose in rebellion after Herod's death, while Augustus governed the Romans and Quintilius Varus held the country. And how, in the 12th year of Nero's reign, the war broke out. The events involving Cestius and all that the Jews accomplished by arms in their first onslaughts, and how they fortified the surrounding towns. And how Nero, alarmed at Cestius's setbacks for the whole enterprise, put Vespasian in charge of the war. How Vespasian, with the elder of his sons, invaded the land of the Jews with what forces of the Romans he used, and how many allies were cut down throughout Galilee. And how, of its cities, some he took entirely by force and others by surrender. At which point I will also describe the discipline of the Romans in war and the training of their legions, the extent and nature of both Galilee's, the boundaries of Judea, and further the peculiar character of the country, its lakes and springs, and the sufferings that befell each captured city, described with precision, as I saw them or endured them myself, for I will not conceal even my own misfortunes, since I mean to speak to people who already know them. Then, how, with the Jews' fortunes already failing, Nero died, and Vespasian, having set out for Jerusalem, was drawn back by his elevation to supreme power. The signs that appeared to him concerning this, and the revolutions at Rome, and how he himself was proclaimed emperor by the soldiers against his own will. And on his departure to administer the whole empire, how sedition broke out among the Jews, how the tyrants rose up against them, and their quarrels with one another. And how Titus, setting out from Egypt, invaded the country a second time. What forces he gathered, where and how many, and in what state internal strife had left the city at his arrival. How many assaults he mounted and how many earthworks he raised. The circuits of the three walls and their measurements, the strength of the city, and the layout of the sanctuary and the temple, and further the measurements of the altar as well, all with precision. Certain customs of the festivals, the seven purifications, and the priests' ministrations, and further the vestments of the priests and of the high priest, and the character of the temple's holy place, concealing nothing and adding nothing to what has been discovered. Next, I will set out the cruelty of the tyrants toward their own countrymen and the restraint of the Romans toward foreigners, and how often Titus, wishing to save the city and the temple, invited the insurgents to come to terms. And I will distinguish the sufferings of the populace and the calamities they endured. However many were brought low and captured by war, by internal strife, or by famine. Nor will I pass over the misfortunes of the deserters or the punishments of the captives. How the temple was burned against Caesar's will, and how much of the sacred treasures was seized from the fire. the capture of the whole city, and the signs and portents that preceded it, the captivity of the tyrants, the number of those enslaved, and the fate to which each was allotted, and how the Romans went on to deal with what remained of the war and tore down the fortified strongholds. Titus's traversal of the whole country, restoring order to it, and finally his return to Italy and his triumph. All this I have set out in 7 books, leaving no ground for reproach or accusation to those who know the facts and were present at the war, at least to those who love the truth, for I have written it not to please, but as it happened. I will make this the beginning of my narrative, the same beginning I gave among my chapter headings. When strife broke out among the powerful men of the Jews, at the time when Antiochus, called Epiphanes, was contending with Ptolemy VI for possession of the whole of Syria, their rivalry turned on supremacy, each man of rank refusing to submit to his equals. Onias, one of the high priests, gained the upper hand and expelled the sons of Tobias from the city. They fled to Antiochus and begged him to use them as guides and invade Judea. The king agreed, having long been eager to do so, and setting out himself with a very great force, he took the city by storm and killed a great number of Ptolemy's partisans. Letting his soldiers loose without restraint to plunder, he himself pillaged the temple and put a stop to the daily sacrifice for 3 years and 6 months. The high priest Onias fled to Ptolemy and, receiving from him a place in the district of Heliopolis, founded a small town modeled on Jerusalem and built a temple like it there, of which we will speak again in its proper place. But for Antiochus, neither his unexpected mastery of the city nor the plundering and the great slaughter were enough. Overcome by the violence of his passions and remembering what he had suffered during the siege, he tried to force the Jews to abandon their ancestral laws, to leave their infants uncircumcised, and to sacrifice swine upon the altar. All refused, and the most eminent among them were slaughtered. Bacchides, the garrison commander sent by Antiochus, adding to his natural cruelty these impious orders, left no excess of lawlessness untried, torturing the notable men one by one and daily displaying to the city, as a group, the spectacle of its own coming ruin. Until, driven by the excess of these wrongs, he goaded the sufferers into daring resistance. Mattathias, then, son of Asamoneus, one of the priests from a village called Modin, gathered his own household about him, for he had 5 sons, and killed Bacchides with daggers. Then, fearing at once the numbers of the garrison, he fled to the mountains. But as many of the people joined him, he took heart and came down again. He met the generals of Antiochus in battle and defeated them, driving them out of Judea. Passing from success to power, and because he had freed his people from foreign rule, ruling them now with their own consent, he died, leaving the leadership to Judas, the eldest of his sons. Judas, supposing that Antiochus would not remain quiet, mustered the forces of the region and was the first to make an alliance with the Romans. And when Epiphanes invaded the country again, he repelled him with a heavy blow. Fresh from this success, he moved against the garrison in the city, which had not yet been dislodged, and, driving the soldiers out of the upper city, forced them back into the lower, the part of the town called the Acra. Having gained control of the temple, he cleansed the whole precinct and walled it round, had new vessels made for its ministrations, and brought them into the sanctuary, since the old ones had been defiled, built another altar, and began the sacrifices anew. But just as the city was recovering its sacred order, Antiochus died, and his son, also named Antiochus, inherited both the kingdom and the hatred toward the Jews. Gathering 50,000 infantry, 5,000 cavalry, and 80 elephants, he invaded Judea through the hill country. He took the small town of Bethsura, and at a place called Bethzachariah, where the pass was narrow, Judas met him with his forces. But before the lines could close, his brother Eleazar, catching sight of the tallest of the elephants, adorned with a great tower and gilded outworks, and supposing Antiochus himself to be mounted upon it, ran far out ahead of his own men, cut through the enemy's ranks, and made his way to the elephant. He could not reach the man he took for the king, because of the height, but he struck the beast under the belly, bringing it crashing down upon himself. He was crushed and died, having accomplished nothing more than he had set his heart on great deeds and put fame ahead of his own life. Yet the man who drove the elephant was only a common soldier, and even if it had been Antiochus himself, the one who dared this would have gained nothing more than the appearance of choosing death in hope of a glorious success. The whole battle turned into an omen for his brother as well, since the Jews fought hard and held out for a long time, but the king's forces, superior in numbers and favored by fortune, prevailed. And after killing many of them, Judas took the survivors and fled to the district of Gophna. Antiochus advanced to Jerusalem and stayed there a few days, but withdrew for lack of provisions, leaving behind a garrison he judged sufficient and marching the rest of his army off to winter in Syria. Once the king had withdrawn, Judas did not rest. Many from the nation joined him, and gathering up those who had survived the battle, he engaged Antiochus's generals at the village of Edessa. There he proved himself outstanding in the fighting, killed many of the enemy, and was himself killed, and a few days later his brother John was murdered through a plot by men loyal to Antiochus. His brother Jonathan succeeded him. He kept a watchful guard over affairs with the local population, strengthened his rule through friendship with the Romans, and made a treaty with the son of Antiochus. None of this, however, was enough to secure him. Trypho, the usurper who served as guardian of Antiochus's son but had long been plotting against him, tried to remove Jonathan's friends. When Jonathan came to Ptolemais with a small escort to meet Antiochus, Trypho seized him by treachery, put him in chains, and marched on Judea. But he was driven off by Simon, Jonathan's brother, and in his rage at the defeat, he killed Jonathan. Simon took command with distinction. He captured Gazara, Joppa, and Jamnia, towns in the neighborhood, and after overcoming its garrison, razed the citadel as well. He then became an ally of Antiochus against Trypho, whom Antiochus was besieging at Dora before his campaign against the Medes. But helping to destroy Trypho did nothing to check the king's greed. Not long after, Antiochus sent his general Cendebeus with an army to ravage Judea and subdue Simon. Although now an old man, Simon conducted the war with youthful vigor. He sent his sons ahead with the strongest of his men, while he himself took a division of the army and advanced by another route. Setting many ambushes in the hills, he succeeded in every plan and won a brilliant victory. He was declared high priest, and 170 years after the Macedonian domination began, he freed the Jews from it. But he too died by treachery, murdered at a banquet by Ptolemy, his son-in-law, who had shut up Simon's wife and two of his sons, and sent men to kill the third, John, who was also called Hyrcanus. Learning of the attempt in advance, the young man hurried to reach the city, relying above all on the people's memory of his father's achievements and their hatred of Ptolemy's lawlessness. Ptolemy also tried to enter by another gate, but was quickly driven back by the people, who had already welcomed Hyrcanus. He withdrew at once to one of the strongholds above Jericho called Dagon. Hyrcanus, having recovered his father's high priesthood and offered sacrifice to God, hastened against Ptolemy to help his mother and brothers, and, attacking the fortress, had the upper hand in every other respect, but was defeated by his own sense of justice. Whenever Ptolemy was hard-pressed, he brought Hyrcanus's mother and brothers up onto the wall in plain view, tortured them, and threatened to throw them down unless Hyrcanus withdrew at once. At this, pity and fear overcame Hyrcanus's anger, but his mother gave in neither to the torments nor to the death threatened against her. She stretched out her hands and begged her son not to be swayed by her outrage into sparing that godless man, since for her a death at Ptolemy's hands, exacting punishment for the crimes he had committed against their house, was better than immortality. Whenever John recalled his mother's fortitude and heard her pleading, he was moved to press the attack, but whenever he saw her being beaten and torn, he grew soft and was overcome entirely by his feelings. Because the siege dragged on for this reason, the sabbatical year set in, which the Jews leave fallow every 7 years just as they rest on the seventh day. During this time, Ptolemy, released from the siege, killed John's brothers along with their mother and fled to Zeno, surnamed Cotyles, who was tyrant of Philadelphia. Antiochus, angered by what he had suffered at Simon's hands, marched into Judea and besieged Hyrcanus, laying siege to Jerusalem. Hyrcanus opened the tomb of David, who had been the wealthiest of kings, and removed from it more than 3,000 talents of silver. With 300 talents of this, he persuaded Antiochus to lift the siege, and he became the first of the Jews to hire foreign mercenaries out of his surplus wealth. Later, when Antiochus campaigned against the Medes, this gave Hyrcanus his chance for revenge, and he at once set out against the cities of Syria, expecting to find them stripped of their best fighting men, which proved correct. He himself captured Medaba and Samaga, along with their neighboring towns, as well as Shechem and Gerizim, and along with these the nation of the Cutheans, who lived around the temple built in imitation of the one in Jerusalem. He also took a good many towns in Idumea, including Adora and Marissa. He advanced as far as Samaria, where the city of Sebaste now stands, built by King Herod, and after walling it in on every side, he set his sons Aristobulus and Antigonus over the siege. When the Samaritans refused to yield, famine drove the people in the city to eat food unfit even to be named. They called on Antiochus, surnamed Aspendius, to help them, and he readily agreed, but was defeated by Aristobulus's forces. Pursued by the brothers as far as Scythopolis, he escaped, while they turned back against the Samaritans, shut the whole population up inside the wall again, and, after taking the city, razed it to the ground and enslaved its inhabitants. With their successes still mounting, they did not slacken their drive, but pressed on with the army as far as Scythopolis, overran it, and divided up between them the whole region south of Mount Carmel. But envy at the good fortune of John and his sons stirred up sedition among the local population, and many gathered against them and would not stay quiet until they were driven to open war and defeated. For the rest of his life, John lived in prosperity, managed the affairs of his rule in the finest way, and died after 33 years, leaving 5 sons, truly blessed and allowed by fortune no grounds whatever for complaint on his own account. He alone possessed the 3 greatest things: rule over the nation, the high priesthood, and the gift of prophecy. For the divine spoke with him, so that he was ignorant of nothing that was to come. Indeed, he foresaw and foretold concerning 2 of his elder sons that they would not remain masters of affairs. Their downfall deserves to be told, showing how far they fell short of their father's good fortune. After their father's death, the eldest, Aristobulus, converted the rule into a kingship and was the first to put on the diadem, 471 years and 3 months after the people had returned to their own land, freed from slavery in Babylon. Of his brothers, he kept the one next to him in age, Antigonus, whom he appeared to love, on an equal footing with himself, but the others he had chained and imprisoned. He also imprisoned his mother, who disputed his authority with him, for John had left her as mistress of the whole realm, and he carried his cruelty so far that he let her die of starvation in chains. Retribution for these acts fell in turn on his brother Antigonus, whom he loved and had made partner in the kingship, for he killed him too, on the strength of slanders concocted by wicked men at court. At first Aristobulus disbelieved what they said, both because he loved his brother and because he attributed much of what was being reported to envy. But when Antigonus, splendid from a military campaign, arrived for the festival at which it is the ancestral custom to build booths for God, it happened that Aristobulus fell ill in those very days, and Antigonus, at the close of the festival, went up as magnificently equipped as possible with the armed men around him, chiefly to honor his brother. At that moment, the wicked men went to the king and told him about the parade of armed men and about Antigonus's bearing, greater than that of a private citizen, saying that he had come with so large a force in order to kill him, since he could not bear holding mere honor from the kingship when it was in his power to seize it outright. Little by little, and against his will, Aristobulus was won over by these reports, and, taking care that his suspicion should not become apparent and arranging in advance against the uncertain outcome, he stationed his bodyguards in one of the dim underground chambers. He himself was then lodging in the fortress once called Bares, later renamed Antonia, with orders to leave Antigonus alone if he came unarmed, but to kill him if he approached in arms. And he sent men to Antigonus, telling him in advance to come unarmed. At this, the queen, with great cunning, conspired with the plotters. They persuaded the messengers sent to Antigonus to say nothing of what the king had actually said, but instead to tell Antigonus that his brother, hearing he had prepared magnificent arms and military equipment for him in Galilee, was prevented by his illness from inspecting it himself, and that now, since Antigonus was about to leave, he would be delighted to see him in his armor. Hearing this, and led on by his brother's evident affection to suspect nothing wicked, Antigonus went forward in his arms as if for a display. But when he reached the dark passage called the Tower of Strato, he was killed by the bodyguards, proving beyond doubt that slander destroys every kind of goodwill and natural affection, and that of all good feelings none is so strong as to hold out forever against envy. One might well marvel, in this connection, at Judas and Essene by birth, who was never once mistaken or found false in his predictions. When he saw Antigonus passing through the temple on that very day, he cried out to his companions, and there were not a few of them sitting with him, students of his teaching. "Ah, how good it would be for me to die now, since the truth has died before me and one of my own predictions has proved false. For this Antigonus is alive today, though he was fated to be killed." The place fixed for his slaughter was Strato's tower, and that place is 600 stadia from here, and it is already the fourth hour of the day. The time itself refutes the prophecy. Having said this, the old man remained troubled and downcast, and shortly afterward news came that Antigonus had been killed in the underground chamber, which was itself also called Strato's Tower, sharing its name with the coastal city of Caesarea. This, then, was what threw the seer into confusion. As for Aristobulus, remorse for his crime struck him at once with sickness, and with his mind forever troubled by the thought of the murder, he wasted away until his innards, torn apart by his unmixed grief, brought up a great quantity of blood. One of the attendants carrying this away slipped, by some divine providence, at the very spot where Antigonus had been slaughtered, and poured out the blood of the murderer onto the bloodstains from the killing still visible there. At once a cry of grief rose from those who saw it, as though the young man had deliberately poured a libation of blood on that very spot. Hearing the outcry, the king asked the reason. When no one dared to speak, he pressed all the harder, wanting to learn the truth, until at last, under threats and force, they told him what had happened. He filled his eyes with tears, and, groaning with all the strength left in him, said, "So then I was not going to escape the great eye of God as I committed unholy deeds, but swift justice pursues me for the blood of my own kin. How much longer, most shameless body, will you hold on to a soul condemned by a brother and a mother? How much longer shall I pour out my own blood to them drop by drop? Let them take it all at once, and let the divine no longer mock itself with libations poured from my own entrails." With these words, he died at once, having reigned no more than a year. His wife released his brothers and made Alexander king, the one who seemed to surpass the others both in age and in moderation. On taking power, he killed one of his brothers, who aspired to the throne, and kept the one who remained, content to live without meddling in affairs, in private life. He also fought a battle against Ptolemy, surnamed Lathyrus, who had taken the city of Ashasus. He killed many of the enemy, but the victory tipped in Ptolemy's favor. After Ptolemy was driven off by his mother Cleopatra and withdrew to Egypt, Alexander took Gadara by siege, and Amathus as well, the greatest of the strongholds beyond the Jordan, which held the most valuable possessions of Theodorus, son of Zeno. But Theodorus fell on him without warning, recovered his own property along with the king's baggage train, and killed as many as 10,000 of the Jews. Alexander recovered from the blow, however, and turning toward the coast, took Gaza, Raphia, and Anthedon, later renamed Agrippias by King Herod. After he had enslaved the populations of these towns, the Jewish people rose against him at a festival, for it is above all at their feasts that sedition takes hold among them. And it seems he would not have gotten the better of the plot had his foreign troops, Pisidians and Cilicians, not come to his aid. For he would not accept Syrians as mercenaries because of their inborn hostility toward the nation. After killing more than 6,000 of the rebels, he turned against Arabia, and, conquering the Gileadites and the Moabites there, imposed tribute on them and returned to Amathus. When Theodorus, terrified by his successes, abandoned the fortress, Alexander took it deserted and razed it. Then, engaging Obed as king of the Arabs, who had set an ambush for him in the region of Gaulonitis, he fell into the trap and lost his whole he lost his army there, crushed together in a deep ravine and trampled by the sheer mass of camels. He himself escaped to Jerusalem, but the scale of the disaster provoked a nation that already hated him into rebellion. Even so, he proved stronger this time, and in a series of battles killed no fewer than 50,000 Jews over 6 years. Yet he took no joy in these victories, since he was wearing down his own kingdom to win them. So he laid down his weapons and tried instead to come to terms with his subjects through negotiation. But this only made them hate him more, both for his change of heart and for the unpredictability of his temper. When he asked what he could do to pacify them, they told him, "Die. A dead man might just possibly be reconciled to people he had wronged so grievously." At the same time, they sent for Demetrius, known as Acheros. He readily answered their call, hoping for greater gains, and when he arrived with an army, the Jews joined forces with his allies near Shechem. Alexander met them both with 1,000 cavalry and 8,000 mercenary infantry, along with about 10,000 Jews still loyal to him. His opponents had 3,000 cavalry and 14,000 infantry. Before the armies clashed, the two kings tried, through public appeals, to win over each other's troops, Demetrius hoping to detach Alexander's mercenaries, Alexander hoping to win back the Jews fighting alongside Demetrius. But when neither the Jews nor the Greeks abandoned their loyalties, the matter was settled by arms. Demetrius won the battle, even though many of Alexander's mercenaries displayed great courage and skill. Yet the outcome of the engagement turned out contrary to what either side expected. The very men who had summoned Demetrius did not stay with him even in victory, while 6,000 Jews, moved to pity by Alexander's reversal of fortune, went over to him as he fled into the mountains. Demetrius could not withstand this shift, reckoning that Alexander was now capable of fighting again, and that the whole nation might drift back to him, he withdrew. Even so, the greater part of the people did not lay down their quarrel with Alexander once his allies had retreated, and the war against him went on relentlessly, until, after killing great numbers, he drove the rest into the town of Bemesales, took it too, and led the captives back to Jerusalem. His rage carried him, through sheer excess, into an act of impiety. Of the prisoners he had taken, he crucified 800 in the middle of the city, and had their wives and children slaughtered before their eyes, all while he sat drinking, reclining among his concubines and looking on. Such terror gripped the people that 8,000 of his opponents fled that very night beyond the borders of Judea altogether, and did not return until Alexander's death. Only by such deeds did he manage, late and with difficulty, to bring peace to his kingdom and lay down his arms. Then a new source of turmoil arose. Antiochus, also called Dionysus, a brother of Demetrius and the last of the line of Seleucus. Alexander, fearing that Antiochus, who had set out to campaign against the Arabs, might turn against him instead, dug a deep trench across the stretch of land between the hill country above Antipatris and the shore at Joppa, raised a high wall in front of the trench, and built wooden towers to block off the easy points of entry. But this did not succeed in stopping Antiochus. He burned the towers, filled in the trench, and drove his army through with the rest of his force. Setting aside for the moment his revenge on the man who had tried to hinder him, he marched at once against the Arabs. Their king withdrew into the more favorable parts of the country for battle, then suddenly wheeled his cavalry, 10,000 strong, and fell upon Antiochus's disordered troops. In the fierce battle that followed, so long as Antiochus lived, his army held its ground, even though the Arabs were cutting them down without mercy. But once he fell, for he had always been the first to risk himself in support of his hard-pressed men, the whole army broke. Most of them perished, either in the battle itself or in the flight that followed, and those who escaped to the village of Cana all died there, save a few, for lack of provisions. After this, the people of Damascus, out of hatred for Ptolemy son of Menius, invited Aretas in and made him king of Celesyria. He marched against Judea, defeated Alexander in battle, and then withdrew under a treaty. Alexander, for his part, took Pella, then advanced on Gerasa, again coveting Theodorus's possessions. He walled the garrison off with a triple line of siege works and took the place by force. He also subdued Galen, Seleucia, and the region called the Ravine of Antiochus. In addition, he captured the strong fortress of Gamala, removed its commander Demetrius from office on numerous charges, and returned to Judea, having completed 3 years of campaigning. The nation welcomed him gladly because of his successes, but the very rest from war brought on the beginning of an illness. Afflicted by fevers that recurred every fourth day, he thought he could shake off the sickness by throwing himself once more into action. so he committed himself to ill-timed campaigns, forcing his body beyond its strength for the sake of activity, and it gave out. He died, in fact, in the midst of turmoil, having reigned 27 years. He left the kingdom to his wife Alexandra, convinced that the Jews would submit to her more readily than to anyone else, since she was as far removed as possible from his own cruelty and had opposed his lawless acts, which had won her the people's goodwill. And her hope was not disappointed. The woman held the throne securely on the strength of her reputation for piety. She was scrupulous above all in observing the ancestral law, and from the outset excluded from public life those who transgressed the sacred laws. She had two sons by Alexander. The elder, Hyrcanus, she appointed high priest, both because of his age and because he was too sluggish by nature to trouble himself with affairs of state generally. The younger, Aristobulus, she kept as a private citizen because of his fiery temperament. Into her administration crept the Pharisees, a group of Jews reputed to be more scrupulously pious than the rest and more exact in their exposition of the laws. Alexandra deferred to them to an extraordinary degree, being wholly given over to religion. They, for their part, gradually took advantage of the woman's simplicity, until they had become, in effect, the administrators of the whole state, free to banish and recall whomever they wished, to release and to imprison. In short, the enjoyment of royal power was theirs, while the expense and the difficulties fell to Alexandra. She proved formidable in managing the larger affairs of state. She kept building up her forces until she had doubled them and gathered no small body of foreign troops, so that she not only held her own nation in check, but was also feared by foreign rulers. Yet while she ruled everyone else, the Pharisees ruled her. They put to death, for instance, a certain Diogenes, a prominent man who had been a friend of Alexander, charging him with having advised the king in the matter of the 800 men who had been crucified. They kept pressing Alexandra to have the rest of those who had provoked Alexander against the victims put to death as well. And yielding to her own superstitious fear, she let them kill whomever they pleased. Those in danger who seemed to be of the highest standing fled to Aristobulus, and he persuaded his mother to spare them, out of respect for their rank, but to send them out of the city if she did not consider them innocent. So, once granted this reprieve, they scattered throughout the country. Alexandra also sent an army against Damascus, on the pretext that Ptolemy was continually harassing the city, but it accomplished nothing of note. She also won over, through treaties and gifts, Tigranes, king of Armenia, who was encamped before Ptolemais and besieging Cleopatra. But he broke off the siege because of unrest at home, after Lucullus had invaded Armenia. Meanwhile, while Alexandra lay ill, her younger son Aristobulus seized the moment, gathered his household servants, of whom he had many, all devoted to him because of his fiery spirit, and took control of every fortress in the land. With the money these yielded, he gathered mercenaries and had himself proclaimed king. Hyrcanus, distressed at this, was pitied by his mother, who confined Aristobulus's wife and children in the Antonia, a fortress adjoining the northern side of the temple, formerly called, as I have said, the Bares, but later renamed, once Antony came to prominence, just as, from Augustus and Agrippa, the cities Sebaste and Agrippias took their names. Before Alexandra could move against Aristobulus for overturning his brother's rule, she died, having governed for 9 years. Hyrcanus was heir to the whole kingdom, which she had entrusted to him even while she lived, but Aristobulus surpassed him in power and in spirit. When the two came to a decisive clash near Jericho, most of Hyrcanus's men deserted him and went over to Aristobulus. Hyrcanus, with those who remained loyal, managed to escape first to the Antonia and seize control of the hostages held there for security, these being Aristobulus's wife and children. Before the affair could turn to real bloodshed, however, the brothers reached an agreement. Aristobulus would be king, while Hyrcanus, stepping aside, would enjoy every other honor due to a king's brother. On these terms, they were reconciled in the temple, and, with the people standing around them, embraced each other warmly and exchanged houses, Aristobulus moving into the palace, and Hyrcanus withdrawing into Aristobulus's own house. But fear now fell upon the rest of Aristobulus's opponents, since he had won power against all expectation, and above all upon Antipater, who had long been his enemy. Antipater was an Idumean by birth, and by virtue of his ancestry, his wealth, and his general power, he stood foremost among his people. It was he who persuaded Hyrcanus, once he had taken refuge with Aretas, king of Arabia, to try to recover his kingdom, and who persuaded Aretas to receive Hyrcanus and restore him to power, heaping abuse on Aristobulus's character, and praising Hyrcanus at length, urging Aretas to receive him, and arguing that it was fitting for the ruler of so splendid a kingdom to extend a helping hand to a man who had been wronged. And Hyrcanus had indeed been wronged, deprived of the rule that belonged to him by right of primogeniture. Having thus prepared them both, he took Hyrcanus by night and slipped away from the city, and by hard, continuous flight made it safely to the place called Petra, the royal seat of Arabia. There he handed Hyrcanus over to Aretas, and by much flattering conversation and many gifts persuaded him to supply a force to restore him. This force numbered 50,000, infantry and cavalry combined, and against it Aristobulus could not hold his ground. Defeated in the first engagement, he was driven back into Jerusalem. He would soon have been taken by storm, had not Scaurus, the Roman commander, intervened at just that moment and lifted the siege. Scaurus had been sent into Syria from Armenia by Pompey the Great, who was then at war with Tigranes. Arriving at Damascus, which had recently been captured by Metellus and Lollius, he removed them from it, and once he learned of events in Judea, hurried there as if to seize a windfall. As soon as he entered the country, envoys came to him at once from each of the brothers, each begging for his help. But 300 talents from Aristobulus outweighed the claims of justice. On receiving this sum, Scaurus sent word to Hyrcanus and the Arabs, threatening them with Rome and Pompey if they did not lift the siege. Aretas, alarmed, withdrew from Judea to Philadelphia, and Scaurus went back to Damascus. But Aristobulus was not content merely to have avoided capture. He gathered his whole force and pursued the retreating enemy. Engaging them near the place called Papyrin, he killed more than 6,000, among them Phalion, the brother of Antipater. Hyrcanus and Antipater, stripped of Arab support, now shifted their hopes to the other side. And when Pompey, advancing through Syria, arrived at Damascus, they took refuge with him, and, setting gifts aside, used the same arguments they had used with Aretas, pleading with him to detest Aristobulus's violence and to restore to the kingship the man to whom it belonged, both by character and by seniority. Nor was Aristobulus slow to act. Trusting in the bribe he had given Scaurus, he too presented himself, arrayed as splendidly as a king could be. But he found it beneath him to court favor in this way, and, unwilling to lower himself to the demands of the moment, he withdrew from the city of Diem. Pompey, angered by this, and moved besides by the entreaties of Hyrcanus's party, set out against Aristobulus, bringing with him the Roman army and a large body of allied troops from Syria. Passing by Pella and Scythopolis, he reached Cori, from which point, going inland, the territory of the Jews begins, and there he heard that Aristobulus had taken refuge at Alexandrium, a fortress built with the greatest lavishness, set on a high mountain. He sent orders for Aristobulus to come down. The king, though summoned, felt the impulse, natural to one used to command, to risk everything rather than obey. But seeing that his people were terrified, and with his friends urging him to consider that Rome's power was irresistible, he yielded to their advice, went down to Pompey, made a long defense of his right to rule, and then returned to the fortress. Then again, at his brother's renewed challenge, he came down, spoke on the justice of his claims, and departed again, Pompey raising no objection. He was caught between hope and fear. He would come down as if to persuade Pompey to concede everything to him, and then go back up to the citadel, so as not to seem to have given himself up too soon. But when Pompey finally ordered him to surrender his fortresses and instructed the garrison commanders, who were bound to obey only written orders in his own hand, he forced Aristobulus to write to each of them, telling them to withdraw. Aristobulus did as he was ordered, but in anger withdrew to Jerusalem and began preparing for war against Pompey. Pompey, giving him no time to prepare, followed at once, his resolve strengthened further by news, brought to him near Jericho, of the death of Mithridates. It was there in Jericho that the richest part of Judea is found, abundant in palms and in balsam, which the people gather by slitting the trunks with sharp stones and collecting what oozes, weeping, from the cuts. Pompey camped there one evening, and at dawn hastened toward Jerusalem. Terrified at his approach, Aristobulus came to him as a suppliant, promising money and offering to submit himself and the city, and so managed to calm Pompey's anger. But none of what had been agreed came to pass. For the men loyal to Aristobulus would not even let Gabinius, who had been sent to collect the money, into the city. Furious at this, Pompey kept Aristobulus under guard, went up to the city himself, and surveyed it to determine how best to attack. Seeing that the strength of its walls made it hard to approach, that the ravine before them was formidable, and that the temple within the ravine was fortified more strongly still, so that even if the city itself fell, there would be a second this was a refuge for the defenders. For a long time, the people inside were undecided, until factional strife broke out. Aristobulus's supporters wanted to fight and rescue the king, while Hyacinus's supporters wanted to open the gates to Pompey. Fear of Roman discipline drove many of the people to side with the latter. Beaten, Aristobulus's party withdrew into the temple and cut away the bridge connecting it to the city, preparing to hold out to the end. The other faction let the Romans into the city and handed over the palace. Pompey sent in one of his own officers, Piso, with a force to take charge of these. Piso stationed garrisons through the city, and since he could not persuade by argument any of those who had fled into the temple to come to terms, he made the surrounding ground ready for an assault, with Hyacinus's men eager in both planning and service. Pompey himself set up on the north side, filling the ditch and the whole ravine there, his troops hauling in timber from everywhere. It was hard to fill the ravine, its depth being immense and the Jews blocking every attempt from above. The work would have gone on forever for the Romans had Pompey not watched for the Sabbaths, on which the Jews, out of religious scruple, refrain from all labor. He raised his siege mound on those days, keeping his soldiers back from hand-to-hand fighting, since on the Sabbath the Jews defend only their own persons. Once the ravine was filled, he set high towers on the mound, brought up the siege engines shipped from Tyre, and began battering the wall. The defenders' stone throwers kept driving off those working from above. The towers on this side held out longest, being finer and larger than the rest. The Romans suffered heavily here, and Pompey marveled at the Jews' endurance in general, and above all at how they let nothing interrupt their worship even amid a hail of missiles. As if the city were at perfect peace, the daily sacrifices, libations, and every rite of divine service were carried out to the last detail. And even at the moment of capture, while being cut down beside the altar, they did not abandon their daily observances. In the third month of the siege, the Romans finally brought down one of the towers and broke into the temple. The first man bold enough to scale the wall was Faustus Cornelius, son of Sulla, followed by two centurions, Furius and Fabius, each with his own company. Surrounding the temple on every side, they killed some as they fled for refuge to the sanctuary, others as they made a brief stand. Many priests, seeing the enemy bearing down on them swords in hand, stayed calmly at their duties and were cut down while pouring libations and burning incense, putting the service of God above their own survival. Most of the dead, though, fell at the hands of their own countrymen in the opposing faction, and many, in desperation, threw themselves from the cliffs. Some near the wall, driven mad by their helplessness, set fires and burned along with them. 12,000 Jews were killed, very few Romans died, though more were wounded. Nothing in that catastrophe struck the nation harder than the exposure, by foreigners, of the holy place that until then had been unseen. Pompey with his staff went into the sanctuary, a place only the high priest was permitted to enter, and viewed what was inside. The lampstand and its lamps, the table, the libation vessels, the censers, all of solid gold, a great heap of spices, and sacred treasure amounting to 2,000 talents. He touched none of this, nor any other sacred object, and the day after the capture, he ordered the temple attendants to purify the sanctuary and resume the customary sacrifices. He then reappointed Hyacinus high priest, both for the eagerness he had shown throughout the siege and because he had kept the population of the countryside from joining Aristobulus's war effort. By this, as a good commander should, he won the people's support more through goodwill than through fear. Among the captives was Aristobulus's father-in-law, who was also his uncle. Pompey executed by the axe those most responsible for the war, while rewarding Faustus and the men who had fought bravely with him with splendid decorations, and imposed tribute on the country and on Jerusalem. He stripped the nation of the cities it had taken in Celesyria, placing them under the Roman governor appointed over that region, and confined the Jews within their own borders alone. He rebuilt Gadara, which the Jews had razed, as a favor to a certain Demetrius of Gadara, one of his own freedmen. He also freed from Jewish control the inland cities that had escaped destruction, Hippos, Scythopolis, Pella, Samaria, Jamnia, Marissa, Azotus, and Arethusa, and likewise the coastal cities of Gaza, Joppa, and Dora, along with the city once called Strato's Tower, later rebuilt with magnificent works by King Herod and renamed Caesarea. All of these he restored to their native inhabitants and assigned to the province of Syria. He put this province, together with Judea and the territory as far as Egypt and the Euphrates, under Scaurus's administration, with two legions, while he himself hurried through Cilicia to Rome, bringing Aristobulus and his family as captives. Aristobulus had two daughters and two sons. One son, Alexander, escaped along the way, while the younger, Antigonus, was carried to Rome with his sisters. Meanwhile, Scaurus invaded Arabia, but was kept from Petra by the difficult terrain, though he ravaged the surrounding country widely, suffering hardship in the process since his army was starving. Hyrcanus came to his aid by sending supplies through Antipater. Scaurus, knowing Antipater was on friendly terms with Aretas, sent him to negotiate an end to the war for money. The Arab king agreed to pay 300 talents, and on these terms Scaurus withdrew his forces from Arabia. Alexander, Aristobulus's son who had escaped from Pompey, in time gathered a considerable force and became a heavy burden to Hyrcanus, overrunning Judea. It seemed he would soon overthrow him, since he was already bold enough to attempt rebuilding the wall in Jerusalem that Pompey had torn down. But Gabinius, sent to Syria as Scaurus's successor, proved himself a capable man in many affairs and marched against Alexander. Alexander, alarmed at his approach, gathered an even larger force, amounting to 10,000 infantry and 1,500 cavalry, and fortified strategic places, Alexandrian, Hyrcania, and Machaerus, near the Arabian mountains. Gabinius sent Mark Antony ahead with part of the army, and himself followed with the whole force. Antipater's picked men and the rest of the Jewish contingent, commanded by Malichus and Pithelaus, joined Antony's officers and went out to meet Alexander, before long Gabinius arrived with the main body. Faced with the united enemy force, Alexander did not stand his ground but withdrew, and near Jerusalem was forced to give battle. He lost 6,000 men in the fighting, 3,000 killed and 3,000 taken prisoner, and fled with the survivors to Alexandrian. When Gabinius arrived there and found many entrenched, he first tried, before fighting, to win them over by promising pardon for their offenses. When they would not listen to reason, he killed many of them and shut the rest up in the fortress. In this battle, the commander Mark Antony distinguished himself, always brave everywhere, but never so much as here. Leaving men to reduce the fortress, Gabinius himself moved on, restoring cities that had not been destroyed and rebuilding those that had. At his order, Scythopolis, Samaria, Anthedon, Apollonia, Jamnia, Raphia, Marissa, Adora, Gabala, Azotus, and many others were resettled, their inhabitants gladly flocking to each. After seeing to this, he returned to Alexandrian and pressed the siege harder, until Alexander, giving up on the whole enterprise, sent envoys asking pardon for his offenses and surrendered the captured fortresses, Hyrcania and Machaerus, and later Alexandrian as well. Gabinius, at the urging of Alexander's mother, demolished all of these so they could not again serve as a base for a second war. She came to appease Gabinius out of fear for the captives at Rome, her husband, and her other children. After this, Gabinius brought Hyrcanus back to Jerusalem and entrusted him with the care of the temple, while setting the rest of the administration in the hands of the leading men. He divided the whole nation into five councils, assigning one to Jerusalem, one to Gadara, one to render account at Amathus, a fourth allotted to Jericho, and for the fifth Sepphoris was designated a city of Galilee. The people, glad to be freed from rule by a single man, were governed from then on by an aristocracy. Not long after, however, trouble began again for them. Aristobulus escaped from Rome and once more rallied many Jews to him, some eager for change, others devoted to him from before. At first, he seized Alexandrian and tried to refortify it, but when Gabinius sent an army against him under Sicina, Antony, and Servianus, he learned of it and withdrew to Machaerus. There he discharged the useless crowd and kept with him only the armed men, about 8,000, among them Pithelaus, the former deputy commander at Jerusalem, who had deserted to him with 1,000 men. The Romans pursued, and in the engagement that followed Aristobulus's men held out bravely for a long while. But at last, overwhelmed by the Romans, 5,000 fell, about 2,000 fled to a hill, and the remaining 1,000, with Aristobulus, cut through the Roman line and made for Machaerus. There, on the first night, the king camped among the ruins, hoping to gather another force once the fighting eased, and fortified the stronghold as best he could. But when the Romans attacked, he held out for 2 days beyond what his strength allowed and was captured, along with his son Antigonus, who had fled with him from Rome. He was taken in chains to Gabinius, and from Gabinius back to Rome, where the Senate imprisoned him. His children, however, Gabinius sent on to Judea, having promised this by letter to Aristobulus's wife in exchange for the surrender of the strongholds. When Gabinius was setting out to campaign against the Parthians, Ptolemy stood in his way. Turning back from the Euphrates, Ptolemy led him down into Egypt, making full use along the way of Hyrcanus and Antipater for every need. Antipater supplied money, weapons, grain, and auxiliaries, and persuaded the Jews guarding the approaches at Pelusium to let Gabinius pass. Meanwhile, the rest of Syria rose up at Gabinius's departure, and Alexander, Aristobulus's son, again incited the Jews to revolt. Gathering a very large force, he set out to destroy every Roman in the country. Alarmed at this, Gabinius, who had just returned from Egypt in haste because of the disturbances there, sent Antipater ahead to some of the rebels and won them over by persuasion. But 30,000 remained with Alexander, and he was determined to fight. So Gabinius marched out to battle, the Jews came to meet him, and in the clash near Mount Tabor 10,000 were killed and the rest of the multitude scattered in flight. Gabinius then came to Jerusalem and settled the constitution as Antipater wished. From there, he marched out, defeated the Nabateans in battle, and secretly sent away Mithridates and Orsanes, who had fled from the Parthians, though he told his soldiers they had escaped. At this point, Crassus arrived as his successor and took over Syria. Setting out on his campaign against the Parthians, Crassus stripped away all the remaining gold from the temple at Jerusalem and carried off the 2,000 talents that Pompey had left untouched. He crossed the Euphrates and there perished, along with his army, a matter not to be told here. After Crassus, Cassius checked the Parthians, who were eager to cross over into Syria, by escaping into the province and securing it. He then hurried against the Jews, took Taricheia, and sold about 30,000 Jews into slavery. He also killed Pithelaus, who was stirring up Aristobulus's partisans, and Antipater advised this killing. Antipater, who had married a woman of noble Arabian birth named Cypros, had 4 sons by her, Phasael and the future King Herod, and besides these, Joseph, Pheroras, and a daughter, Salome. He had won over the most powerful men everywhere with ties of friendship and hospitality, and above all the Arab king, through his marriage connection. And when he took up the war against Aristobulus, he sent his children to the Arab king for safekeeping. Cassius, having forced Alexander by treaty to keep the peace, returned to the Euphrates to block the Parthian crossing, a matter we shall speak of elsewhere. Meanwhile, Caesar, after Pompey and the Senate had fled across the Ionian Sea and he had made himself master of Rome and of the whole state, released Aristobulus from his chains, gave him 2 legions, and sent him quickly to Syria, hoping to win over that province and, through him, the affairs of Judea with ease. But envy outran both Aristobulus's zeal and Caesar's hopes. He was poisoned by men loyal to Pompey, and for a long time was denied even burial in his native land. His body lay preserved in honey until Antony sent it to the Jews to be buried in the royal tombs. His son Alexander was also put to death, beheaded at Antioch by Scipio on Pompey's orders, after a formal charge was brought against him for the harm he had done to the Romans. His siblings were taken in by Ptolemy, son of Menneus, who ruled Chalcis under Lebanon. He sent his son Philippian to fetch them at Ascalon. Philippian took Antigonus and his sisters away from Aristobulus's widow and brought them to his father, but smitten with love, married one of the sisters himself, and was afterward killed by his own father because of her. For Ptolemy killed his son and married Alexandra himself. Because of this marriage, he showed himself more solicitous toward his brothers-in-law. After Pompey's death, Antipater changed sides and cultivated Caesar. When Mithridates of Pergamum, leading the force he was bringing against Egypt, was held up at Ascalon and blocked from the approaches to Pelusium, Antipater, drawing on his connections as a guest friend, persuaded the Arabs to come to his aid and himself arrived leading close to 3,000 Jewish men-at-arms. He also roused the powerful men of Syria to lend assistance, Ptolemy, the settler of the Lebanon, and Iamblichus, through whom the cities of that region readily joined the war effort. Mithridates, now emboldened by the strength Antipater had added to him, marched on Pelusium, and when he was prevented from passing through, laid siege to the city. In the assault, Antipater distinguished himself above all. Breaching the section of the wall opposite him, he was the first to leap into the city with his men. Pelusium was taken, but as Mithridates pressed on, he was again blocked, this time by the inhabitants of the district called the Land of Onias, Jews of Egyptian residence. Antipater persuaded these not merely to stop obstructing, but to supply the army with provisions, with the result that even the people of Memphis no longer offered resistance and instead went over to Mithridates of their own accord. Mithridates, having now made his way round the delta, engaged the rest of the Egyptians in battle at a place called the Camp of the Jews. He and his entire right wing were in danger in the fighting when Antipater came round along the riverbank and rescued him, for on his own side, holding the left wing, he had already prevailed, then fell upon the men pursuing Mithridates, killed many of them, and pursued the survivors so far that he even captured their camp. He lost only 80 of his own men, while Mithridates lost about 800 in the rout. Saved beyond his hope, Mithridates became an unstinting witness before Caesar to Antipater's achievements. Caesar at that time spurred the man on with praise and with hopes for the dangers he would still face on his behalf. And in all of these, Antipater proved the most reckless of fighters, wounded many times over nearly his whole body, bearing on it the marks of his courage. Later, when he had settled affairs in Egypt and returned to Syria, Caesar granted him Roman citizenship, exemption from taxation, and, out of honor and goodwill, made him an object of envy, and on his account confirmed Hyrcanus in the high priesthood as well. About this same time, Antigonus, son of Aristobulus, who was present before Caesar, unexpectedly became the cause of still greater advancement for Antipater. For rather than lamenting that his father seemed to have been poisoned over his quarrels with Pompey, and rather than reproaching Scipio's cruelty toward his brother, and mixing no envious passion into his plea for pity, he instead came forward and accused Hyrcanus and Antipater of this, that they had most lawlessly driven him and his brothers from all their ancestral land, and that out of excess they themselves had committed many outrages against the nation, and that the force they had sent to Egypt they had sent not out of goodwill toward Caesar, but out of fear stemming from their old quarrels and to shed their friendship with Pompey. In response to this, Antipater tore off his cloak and displayed the number of his wounds, saying that concerning his goodwill toward Caesar, there was no need of words on his part, for his body cried out even while he kept silent. As for Antigonus's audacity, he said he marveled at it, that a son of an enemy of Rome, and of a fugitive from Rome, with a hereditary bent for revolution and faction himself, should attempt to bring accusations against others before the Roman commander and try to gain some advantage, when he ought to be content simply to be alive. For even now, he craved power not so much out of need as in order to come forward, and set the Jews at odds with one another and use against those who had given him his opportunities the very resources they had given him. Hearing this, Caesar declared Hyrcanus the more worthy of the high priesthood, and gave Antipater his choice of office. Antipater, leaving the measure of his honor to the one who was honoring him, was appointed procurator of all Judea, and obtained in addition permission to rebuild the walls of his homeland, which had been torn down. Caesar ordered these honors inscribed on the Capitol, as a mark both of his own justice and of the man's future merit. Antipater, having escorted Caesar out of Syria, returned to Judea. There he first rebuilt the wall of his homeland that Pompey had torn down, and then went about the country suppressing the disturbances that had broken out, acting toward each community both as one who threatens and as one who advises, that if they held to Hyrcanus's cause, they would live in prosperity and quiet, enjoying their own possessions and the common peace. But if they were persuaded by the cold hopes of those bent on revolution for their own private gain, they would find him a master instead of a protector, and Hyrcanus a tyrant instead of a king, and the Romans and Caesar enemies instead of rulers and friends, for they would not tolerate the removal from power of the man they themselves had installed. Even as he said this, he was in fact establishing his own control over the country, seeing that Hyrcanus was sluggish and too feeble for kingship. Phasael, the eldest of his sons, he appointed governor of Jerusalem and its surrounding district, and Herod, the next after him, though quite young, he sent out on equal terms to Galilee. Herod, being by nature vigorous, immediately found material for his ambition. Catching Hezekiah, the brigand chief, who was overrunning the districts bordering Syria with a very large band, he seized and killed him along with many of the brigands. This above all won him the gratitude of the Syrians. Indeed, Herod was celebrated in the villages and in the cities as one who had restored peace to them and safeguarded their possessions. It was through this that he also became known to Sextus Caesar, a relative of the great Caesar and governor of Syria. And rivaling his brother's good repute, Phasael too competed in the same honorable contest, winning over the people of Jerusalem to greater goodwill toward himself. And though he held the city in his own hands, never abusing his power in any tasteless way. From this Antipater came to enjoy from the nation a royal court of attendance and honors from everyone as though he were master of all. Yet he himself never shifted at all from his goodwill or loyalty toward Hyrcanus. But it is impossible in times of prosperity to escape envy. Hyrcanus was already, quietly, on his own, being gnawed by resentment at the young men's renown. And above all, he was distressed by Herod's successes and by the constant stream of messengers proclaiming each new triumph. And many of the envious men at court, whom either the sons or Antipater's moderation had offended, incited him further, saying that in yielding affairs to Antipater and his sons, he sat holding only the name of king, stripped of power. How long will you go on being deceived into raising up kings against yourself? They no longer even pretend to be mere stewards. They are openly masters, having pushed you aside, since without your order, without your command, Herod has put to death so many men in violation of Jewish law. If he is not king but still a private citizen, he ought to come before the court and answer for himself, to you and to the ancestral laws, which do not permit the killing of men without trial. By these words Hyrcanus was gradually inflamed, and finally, his anger breaking out, he summoned Herod to be tried. Herod, both because his father urged it and because circumstances allowed him confidence, went up, but first secured Galilee with garrisons. He went with a strong body of troops, so that he would neither seem, by bringing an impressive force, to be intent on overthrowing Hyrcanus, nor fall unguarded into the grip of envy. Sextus Caesar, fearing for the young man, lest, cut off among his enemies, he should come to harm, sent men to Hyrcanus expressly instructing him to acquit Herod of the capital charge. And Hyrcanus, who in any case was so inclined, for he loved Herod, voted for his acquittal. Herod, however, supposing that he had escaped against the king's wishes, withdrew to Damascus to Sextus, preparing not to obey again if summoned. And once more the wicked men provoked Hyrcanus, saying that Herod had gone off in anger and was making preparations against him. The king, believing this, did not know what to do, seeing that the disagreement had grown greater. But when Herod was appointed general of Celesyria and Samaria by Sextus Caesar, he became formidable, not only through the goodwill of the nation, but through military power as well, and Hyrcanus fell into the utmost fear, expecting at any moment that he would march against him with an army. Nor was he wrong in his surmise. Herod, in anger over the threat of that trial, gathered an army and led it against Jerusalem to depose Hyrcanus.